Welcome to Traffica Europe Radio, Europe's literary radio station, free online. I'm Clayton McKee, and I'm proud to be back with you this week to present the second installment of 2023 European Literature Night. In case you missed part one, it's linked in the show notes for this episode. You can also find it on our website, www.trafficaeurope.org. This week, we'll be showing the second half of European Literature Night. Let's begin with a short tribute to Portuguese poets. This tribute is performed by Pedro Henriquez da Silva, and it includes a tribute to Natalia Correia, Eugenio de Andrade, and Mario Cesarini. There is a reading of a poem from each poet, followed by a musical performance by Pedro. Enjoy.
Thank you, Mirek. Thank you, Unik and Mirek and the Czech Center for organizing this wonderful event so that we have the pleasure to participate in. I would like to, first of all, thank and acknowledge the presence of our Consul General of Portugal in New York, Ambassador Luisa Paes Loh. Thank you so much for being here. And we will pay a tribute to three wonderful poets that would complete 100 years in 2023. A lady and two gentlemen of the Portuguese poetry that in their own time, they marked our cultural scene in Portugal. And I have the pleasure and the honor to be accompanied by the Portuguese guitarist, Pedro Henriques da Silva. Dr. Pedro Henriques da Silva is a professor of Portuguese guitar, and he will delight you with some pieces. And in my not so good ability to recite poems, I will try to do my best. I will recite one poem from each of them in Portuguese so that you can enjoy the magical language that we have and want to share with you, and in English so that everyone is able to understand what they meant to say. So the first poet is Natalia Correia. Natalia was born in 2023, and she was a poet, a social activist, a member of parliament, a defender of human rights and women's rights, and she was a central figure of our scene, of our cultural scene in the 60s, 70s, and till the day she passed away in 1993. Natalia Correia, the poem. I will recite it in Portuguese. O poema. O poema não é o canto, que do grilo para a rosa cresce. O poema é o grilo, é a rosa, e é aquilo que cresce. É o pensamento que exclui uma determinação na fonte de onde ele flui e naquilo que descreve. O poema é o que no homem para lá do homem se atreve. Os acontecimentos são pedras e a poesia transcende-las na já longínqua noção de descrevê-las. E essa própria noção é só uma saudade que se desvanece na poesia, pura intenção de cantar o que não se conhece. The poem. The poem is not the song that grows from the cricket to the rose. The poem is the cricket. It is the rose in which that it grows. It is a thought that excludes a determination in the source from which it flows and it, what it describes. The poem is that in a man beyond the man dares. Events are stones and poetry transcends them in the already distant notion of describing them. And that very notion is only a longing that fades in poetry, pure intention to sing of what you do not know.
Thank you.
Our second author, who would complete 100 years this year, is Eugenio de Andrade, a pseudonym of José Fontenhas. He was born in 2023 and he passed away in 2005. He was a Portuguese poet, very influenced by surrealism, and used concrete images that include earth, water, and the human body to explore such themes as love, nature, and death. His work is widely translated. And the poem I will recite and then Pedro will compose, it's called Words. As palavras. São como cristal, as palavras. Algumas, punhal, incêndio. Outras, orvalho apenas. Secretas vêm, cheias de memórias. Inseguras navegam, barcos ou beijos. As águas estremecem. Desamparadas, inocentes, leves, tecidas são de luz e são a noite. E mesmo pálidas, verdes paraísos lembram ainda. Quem as escuta? Quem as recolhe assim, cruéis, desfeitas, nas suas conchas puras? Words. They are like crystal. Words. Some a dagger. Some a blaze. Others merely do. Secretly they come, full of memory. Insecurely they sail, cockle boats or kisses, the waters trembling. Abandoned, innocent, weightless. They are woven of light, they are the night. And even pallid, they recall green paradise. Who hears them? Who gathers them? Thus cruel, shapeless, in their pure shells. And our last poet for the night, it's Mario Cesarini. Mario Cesarini, similarly to the other two great poets, and this Pedro will play the longest theme. He was a surrealist poet and a painter. He has major works and he was creative and he gave us a poem called Poem. That I'm very happy to recite, and it's a very innovative poem. Poema. Faz-se luz pelo processo de iluminação de sombras. Ora, as sombras existem. As sombras não têm exaustiva vida própria. Não de um e do outro lado da luz, mas no próprio seio dela. Intensamente amantes, loucamente amadas, espalham pelo chão braços de luz cinzenta que se introduzem pelo bico nos olhos do homem. Por outro lado, a sombra de tal luz não ilumina realmente os objetos. Os objetos vivem às escuras, numa perpétua aurora surrealista com a qual não podemos contactar. senão como os amantes de olhos fechados e lâmpadas nos dedos e na boca. Poem. Light occurs when shadows are eliminated. Shadows are what exist. Shadows have their own exhaustive light, not on this or that side of the light, but in its very heart, intensely loving, insanely beloved. And they spread over the ground, their arms of gray light that enter human eyes at the corners. On the other hand, the lights, the shadow called light, doesn't illuminate objects really. Objects live in the dark, in a perpetual surrealist aurora, which we cannot contact, except the way lovers do, with eyes closed and lamps in our fingers, lamps in our lips.
such a wonderful tribute to such amazing poets. The next part of this episode will go into the second panel of European Literature Nights. This panel is titled The Past is Present. It's moderated by Sabir Sultan, who's the Associate Director of World Voices Festival and Literary Programs at PEN America. On this panel, you'll hear from the following authors: Anna Fralick, Laure Segal, Laima Vincea, Katarina Tukova, and Kirmen Uribe. You can also check out the teasers from these authors on Trafica Europe's Archive Radio. I'll be linking that link as well in the show notes. Sit back and enjoy as these authors talk about the role of the past in their writing in the present.
So I will keep this introduction brief. I want to echo Clarice's thanks to UNIC New York and to the Ukrainian Institute, and particularly thanks to Katarina from the Czech Institute for all of her incredible work this evening. Yes. And so tonight, it is my pleasure to introduce our panel, The Past is Present. I want to invite our panelists to come up and take a seat wherever they'd like. And then, so to introduce our incredible panelists, we have Anna Fralick, author of The Ghost of Shakespeare. Anna has taught Polish language and literature at Columbia University for over 3 years, or 3 decades. She has also written 10 books of poetry and 3 bilingual editions. She received the Knight's Cross of the Order of Merit, awarded by the President of Poland. Laima Vincea, author of... Author of Matilda Olkinaite, Unlock Diary, has published over 20 books in the United States, Europe, and the United Kingdom. She has received recognition for her Lithuanian to English translations for the past 30 years. Next is Katarina Tukova. She is the author of the international bestseller, The Last Goddess. She is a Czech novelist and curator and has received the Czech State Award for Literature for the novel Bila Voda and her body of work. Finally, we have Kirmen Uribe, who is the author of 4 novels and 2 poetry collections, including The Past Life of Dolphins. He won the National Prize for Literature in Spain for his first novel, Bilbao, New York, Bilbao, which has been translated into over 15 languages. And unfortunately, Laure Segal won't be able to join our panel this evening. However, you can hear her read from her book, Ladies' Lunch, later tonight. And so, without further ado, let's start. So it is a pleasure to be in conversation with all of you tonight. And I know we have a big topic, the past is present. But I think an easy way to get into it might be a sort of soft landing, where I'd like to ask each of you to begin by talking about your book and then discussing the ways your book wrestles with history, with past cultural figures. And so why don't we begin down at the end with Kirmen, and we'll work our way back up.
Hello, thank you for everybody for coming. Thank you, Sabir. it's a pleasure to be with you here. So yeah, my novel, the title of my novel is The Past, Life of Dolphins, and it comes from a ancient Basque and Atlantic legend that says that dolphins, before, they were humans, but they became dolphins because they love mermaids. So after being the lovers of mermaids, they become dolphins. So it could be bad or good, I don't know. Anyway, I use this Basque legend, ancient Basque legend, to talk about migrants, because I think that migrants also are transformed when they go to one place to another, but not just themselves or ourselves. It's my case too. Also their past also change, also is transformed, because it's not this, the relationship with the past is different when you are in your hometown or when you migrated to another place. So the relationship is different, because the past, it's like it's a kind of fiction. It's a kind of fiction when you leave your country. So why we came here? We came here because I got a Kuhlmann Fellowship at the New York Public Library to do research about an amazing character, an amazing woman, an amazing migrant who came to the United States in the early 20th century. Because she was Hungarian, she was feminist, suffragette, but she had to flee Europe because she couldn't live there, no? Because of the Nazis and because of the communists, both reasons. So she came here and she was living here. She was really, really well known in the United States. She was friend of Einstein, of Gandhi. But then in the Cold War, she died and she went into a complete oblivion. So she was completely forgotten. So I came to the library, and I found that there was a book about her, that because her secretary wanted to write a biography about her, and she was writing that book for 40 years. 40 years writing the same book, can you imagine? And she never finished the book. So, yeah. So I found that unfinished book in the New York Public Library about that so amazing woman. And I think to myself, wow, an unfinished book. So Borges or Bolaño would have killed for it. So that's the story of the novel.
The years, it's terrible, but I can imagine. I wrote my last book for 10 years, and I was lucky enough to finish it. 40 years, my God. Oh, well, so, hello, everyone. It's really nice to be here, and at first, let me introduce my book, or to tell something about something that connects all my books. I turn to the past usually for the topics which interests me, because I'm a woman, and I think that in the past there is a lot of topics and themes which could be told from the women perspective, and I think that we are lacking of these stories still, and especially in Czech history, there are still a lot of to write about in this sense. The same thing I can say about the book The Last Goddess, which describes the story of wise women or healers who lived in the Czech-Slovak borders in Central Europe. There are white Carpathian mountains, so it was healers from the hills who were very very helpful for all the society who lived there, and they cured people for generations. They had deep knowledges of herbal treatment, and they help to people to treat their illnesses, to help their body and mind, and they were also able to mend broken bones. They were also believed that they had some supernatural abilities, like they were able to see into the future and conducted something which we can call love magic, but also they were renowned for, some of them were renowned for making something what we can call black masses to cause someone's death, for example. So they were something like, I don't know, we can tell, shaman of this community. Either we believe in these supernatural abilities or not, still they were able to help people through herbal treatment. And there's abilities, their art of healing was passed down from mother to daughter through centuries. Scientists believe that their art comes from the pagan time. The ethnologist and anthropologist has a see the proof in the enchanting and rituals which were accompanied with enchanting which was told in very old Czech language. That's why they thought it's so old, the all these abilities, all the art. And it was interesting, or what interests me the most on this story or these women was that they were a lot of time illiterate, not ordinary, but still village women, but they were always the threat for the authoritarian system, if we can call Catholic Church authoritarian system. For example, they were, two of them, they were killed in 17th century through during the witch trials. They were also threat for the Nazi regime or Nazi, the commando of intellectuals was called as Hexensonderkommando. It was composed from the writers, historians, and scientists who made a research connected with the goddesses' power. So they considered them also something like, not exactly threat, but really interesting for their own use. And they were also threat for the communist regime, which finally destroyed them. It was the biggest power, the communist regime, because it's a clever tools how to destroy such a phenomenon. For me was really interesting why these women who were so important for the local community was always seen as a threat, and why they were forgotten, because now today no of the goddesses is still alive. Unfortunately, the last one died in the year 2001. Her name was Irma Gabrielová. And before I started to write about them, and before I offered the story to the readers, they were completely forgotten after the many centuries. And I think that to return to the past or to the history of these interesting women is important for us like Czech community or Czech people to understand more our cultural heritage, our interesting rich history, and that it was pity to forget such a valuable story which if it would survive, could be something which we can be proud of and to offer the world as something really interesting. So I think that our past hides a lot of stories which could be lighted on and offered to the readers, and here was a lot of stories which were forgotten or silenced in some cases, really uselessly. I forgot the word, sorry. But it is necessary to offer such a stories to the white audience to be more educated and more known about their own history.
Hello. I am going to buy your book. So I love this. I love this. In fact, my name is a goddess name. Laima is goddess of fortune in Lithuanian. So I'm Laima Vinsa. And so I was born here in the New York area. My mother was born here in the New York area. But I am the daughter of a World War II refugee from Lithuania and the granddaughter of a diplomat in exile. My grandfather, Aniceta Simutis, was the consul general of pre-war independent Lithuania on the west side, on West 86th Street, you know, on a shoestring budget, keeping the spirit of independent Lithuania alive. And so I have really spent my life going backwards into the past, uncovering my Lithuanian identity. But part of my Lithuanian identity is also understanding the Litvak or Lithuanian Jewish identity. And something that's very important to know about this project of mine of bringing Matilda Olkinaitė's poetry and her diary and researching her life and bringing all that to life in the English language and in English language translation is that I felt very strongly that her voice had been silenced as a young woman poet, and her voice needed to be heard. Her voice needed to be heard. So I feel in many ways that I'm speaking for Matilda when I talk about her. So there are many levels of serendipity to Matilda's story. And I should start with something very personal, that growing up here in the New York area, during the Cold War years, when we had little to no contact with Lithuania, Lithuania just seemed like this fantasy land, something, some story land. In fact, Lithuania did not even exist on the map. So when I was growing up in typical in American elementary schools, first day of school, teachers asked, well, where are your parents from? Where are you from? And I would say, Lithuania. And they said, well, show us on the map. And I'd look at the map and I'd see this big red blob, the Soviet Union. I'm like, and they say, well, where is Lithuania? There is no such thing. And so I was always treated as this strange child who was making up fantasy lands and living in her imagination. And I think that I eventually just slipped into my imaginary lands and became a writer and an artist. But throughout my childhood, I had this recurring dream. And in this dream, I was with a few other girls, and I was a teenage girl in the dream. And we were running through a pine forest, and we were being pursued by men in uniform who wanted to kill us. And they finally caught up to us, and each girl is shot one by one, and then I'm shot. And I would have this dream, and later I went to high school in Germany, and I continued having this dream. Now, in the Cold War era, for us, what we knew about the Holocaust, we did not know about the Holocaust by bullets that had taken place in Eastern Europe. We only knew the version of Auschwitz and the gas chambers and what played out towards the end of World War II. So this dream was unfathomable to me. I couldn't understand where it came from. But I do know now that it was coming from some kind of collective unconscious, some kind of knowing. Many Lithuanians rescued Jewish neighbors and friends during the Holocaust in Lithuania, during the German occupation of Lithuania. In fact, statistically, by number of ratio of population, Lithuania is second to the Netherlands in the number of people who risked their lives to help save their Jewish friends and neighbors. But at the same time, there were Lithuanians who collaborated. So it's a very complicated story, and both of those elements are a part of Matilda's story. So now let's fast forward 2017. I was teaching literature in Beijing for a American cultural exchange program, but I was also writing my PhD dissertation at Vilnius University in Lithuania, and my theme was memory and post-memory. And I was looking very closely at memoir by first generation Litvak Holocaust survivors, for example, Samuel Box, painted in words, and then what Lithuanian Christians had experienced during World War II, deportations to Siberia, Soviet occupation, Soviet repressions, the post-war anti-Soviet resistance. So I was looking at these two pieces, but then I was looking at memoirs written by second and third generation Lithuanian American writers who were writing in English, some of them coming from the Jewish line and some from that Christian line. So this was my topic, and I had come back to Lithuania for during autumn holidays. I had to do some work at the university. And a Litwak friend of mine, Phil Shapiro, wrote me an email and he said, there's this amazing young woman in the Rokiškis region who has brought back to life the story of a young poet killed in the Holocaust by bullets in Lithuania, Matilda Olkinaitė, and it's a story based on her poems and her diary. And he said, why don't you go and see it? So I said, okay, that sounds very interesting. I think I'll go. And I was at a poetry festival in the southern part of Lithuania, and I remember I drove for 5 hours in the dark, in the rain. It was autumn, you know, and I managed to get to the theater like literally 5 minutes before the performance was about to start. And I brought a friend of mine along with me who was an ethnographer because I felt she could be very helpful with interpreting this story. And as we were watching this story, and mind you, this was not a professional theater, this is community theater. So the actors are local teachers, construction workers, just regular people. And the story really was, they had taken Matilda Olkinaitė's poetry, which was written in Lithuanian, because she went to Lithuanian schools, even though she was Jewish, and her diary, and performed the story of her childhood up until when her family is killed in the Holocaust. And my friend and I, we were just like, we had tears pouring down our face. We were so moved. But I was listening to her poetry, I said, wait a minute, people have said, oh, this is the poetry that a young girl wrote in her diary. I said, well, no. I mean, she really knew what she was doing as a poet. I mean, there's like very distinct prosody in her poems. And I felt that she was because I was a folk singer in Lithuanian, and so I knew the rhythms and the images of Lithuanian folk song. She grew up in the countryside singing Lithuanian folk songs, and those rhythms and repetitions and refrains were worked into the poems, but then there was Jewish imagery from the Old Testament. You know, and there were poems that questioned, what does it mean to be Jewish at the on the eve of World War II, when she knew about what was going on in Nazi Germany just over the border. So I thought, this is really, you know, I really was very, very moved, and the play ended, and what I found out was that many of those actors were descendants of people who had lived in Matilda's village, where she was murdered by Lithuanian collaborators, she and her family. And so it was very emotional for them because they were also connected to the story. So it's almost like the whole theater is crying, the actors are crying, the director is crying. It's an extremely emotional and cathartic experience. And then the director of the play comes on stage and says, I heard there's a Lithuanian-American literary translator in the audience and we want her to translate Matilda's poems. And I was like, whoa, that's a big responsibility. But after the play, I went and I introduced myself and we immediately bonded and we kind of like had this vision that we wanted to publish. First, we wanted to have Matilda's poems published in Lithuanian and her diary so that people in Lithuania could read it, but then to translate and publish into English. And that led me to actually, you know, getting to see and touch and, you know, the actual diary and poems. And there's a very long story about how the poems survived. That's very, very interesting. And it involves so many levels of serendipity. And if you come to the breakout session later, you'll hear all about it. But long story short, the notebook of poems and Matilda's diary had ended up in the possession of the Holocaust survivor, Irena Veisaitė, who herself had been rescued as a 13-year-old girl during the Holocaust by a Lithuanian family. And so these artifacts were precious to her. So she allowed me to photograph on my phone the poems and the pages of the diary. So when I started translating Matilda's work, I was literally just, you know, using the handwritten text from photos on my phone because we didn't have anything else to work with. But I was very determined for her voice to be heard There was a local Lithuanian historian whose parents had known Matilda's family, had known of the murders, Violeta Alekniene, and she had done research on Matilda's life and had really uncovered a lot of facts. So she showed me around the town that she came from, shared a lot of her research with me, which was the foundation of my work. But then I also had the great good fortune to meet and spend time with Matilda's close childhood friend who she had grown up with, a woman named Lucia. And so she really brought to life everything that Matilda wrote about in her poems and her diary. In fact, one of the poems that we recovered, she had memorized it. It had appeared in a magazine, but it wasn't written down in her notebook. So she recited the poem to me and the director from the theater, and we wrote it down. And then I also translated it. So it's been, you know, there were so many people jumped in and helped with research. Then we started finding that since age 9, indeed, her poems were being published in Lithuanian children's magazines, but we had to find the evidence. So there were researchers from the Rokiškis Museum in Lithuania who were incredible, and they went through the archives, they found copies of those poems. Other people, there's too many people to name, but a lot of different, it was really a group project, pulling together all the research and the photographs and documentation and whatever we could find. The book, The Unlocked Diary, I really owe a debt of gratitude to the artist, Sigute Heblinskaite, for her beautiful design of the book and all the work she did pulling documents and photographs from the archives. This little book, this little chapbook is published by ARC Publications, and it contains a selection of Matilda's poetry in Lithuanian and in English and my essay, introductory essay. So that's probably a lot more easily available, to order. And we have copies here because the book that was published in Lithuania, unfortunately, we don't have very many copies left because it was a very small print run. So that was the whole story of Matilda, is to allow her to speak, because one thing that she wrote in her diary was she was perceived herself as a poet. She wanted to be a poet. She wanted to write. She wanted to publish her first book. But she was also anti-communist. And although her brother joined the Communist Party, so it was interesting how different ideologies in one family. And she wrote in her diary that she refuses to write odes to Stalin, that she's not going to write propagandistic poetry about a bright tomorrow, that she is going to write about the pain of centuries and what she needs to write about. And she acknowledges, well, it's very sad for her, but she felt like she would never see her poems published. But another aspect of her poetry was she had this vision. She was visionary. She really foresaw what would happen to the Jewish population of Lithuania. It's in her poems. She foresaw what would happen. So I hope I haven't taken up too much time, but there's so much to say about Matilda, really. Okay, well, thank you for listening.
Well, I don't know where to start. I would say the book that is here presented is actually is not what I really have written for my whole life, because I started in the grade school as a poet and in Poland and I have written poetry since then and published actually my first four books of poetry were published when I was already on exile, I would say. My family were Polish Jews living in Galicia, Lwów mainly, and they survived. My father in Ural and my mother with me in Kyrgyzstan. I was born in Kyrgyzstan. And when we were returning to Poland, there was no return to Lviv. And Lviv now, right? I grew up in Szczecin, a town to which I was very strongly attached, and I am still in very close contact with the people at the university and writers in Szczecin. However, I did not stay long in Poland because I grew up in Szczecin, and then I went to a university in Warsaw, and then I work in the magazine for blind people. However, there was this war in Israel in 1967, right? And it sort of ignited in Poland quite strong anti-Semitic policy of the communist regime. And we emigrated with my husband and our 2-year-old son. And actually, my poetry is a very big part on the living through exile, the pain of exile, and at certain point, the joy or whatever of assimilation. I don't have my poetry book. I write a little bit of prose also, but the book which we present here is my mainly on my scholarly research. And this is how did it come. Do I have still a few minutes, right? When I came to the United States, I started to publish my poetry in London in the Emigre magazine, Wiadomości. And that was magazine read by in London, in the United States, by Polish emigre circles from the World War II. And at certain point, I thought my life has ended when I came here. I didn't know the language. I had only master degree. But at certain point, I met a professor of New York University, Zoya Yuryev. And when she heard my name, she said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm working in the laboratory." She said, "Your place is at the university. Apply and I will write you a letter of recommendations." She knew my poetry, and that was my recommendation. So the most part of the book contains my articles on Polish poetry, then on Polish prose, and then on Russian symbolism. And why on symbolism? Because when I got to the point when I was supposed to start my work on my dissertation, my professor said, "So what would you like to write about it?" And I said, "I don't know." She said, "You spent 7 months in Rome. The 7 months in Rome when we left Poland, we had to renounce our citizenship. So we were nobodies. And we stayed, Italy allowed us to stay 7 months to work on the visa, on the applying for visa." She said, you spent 7 months in Rome. Why don't you write about Rome in the poetry of Russian symbolism?" And so she told me I usually do what people tell me to do, and I did this. I will return to this in our discussion because it. But so I wrote the dissertation, and there are a few articles about this. And then I wrote on here are essays on writing and exile. So this is the book. But soon my new because my poetry, I mean, I published in exile four books, and then after the change of the of the system in Poland, I publish my books in Polish, but my books were translated into several languages. So this is it.
Thank you. And so I think we've touched a bit about how your books interrogate the past, but I'm curious about the process. So we heard a bit around Matilda and sort of the oral histories and group research you did, Laima. So I'd be curious to hear what your sort of research traditions were, Kierman, and then we can also Katerina too, if we could delve into how you researched your topics for the books. Yeah, let's go down the table. I think we found a process that works.
Okay, so I did research in the New York Public Library about Rosika Schwimmer. She was a Hungarian feminist, pacifist, and Jewish woman. And but while I was, she had an amazing life, and she tried to stop the first World War here, while she was here, and she went to see the President Wilson and try to stop the war, but Wilson wasn't so convinced. So she tried to do the same thing with Henry Ford. So she thought, okay, if I cannot convince the president, I will convince the richest person in the U.S. that at that time was Henry Ford. And they organized like a peace ship to Europe. It was, she had an amazing life, and then she suffered a lot in the Second World War too. But anyway, I went to the New York Public Library, and I was there for 1 year in the archive. It's amazing with the gloves, and yes, you have to use gloves and just a pencil, no pens. It's cold in the place. It's no, it's amazing. So I was there, but I didn't want to write a biography about her. So I didn't want to conclude the book of her secretary. So I don't know. I'm a writer, and I'm always trying to find new new forms of narrative, new forms of literature, like hybrids, so kind of books that goes from non-fiction to fiction. So it's like, here it's like, it's a little bit weird. In the United States, it's like, books are non-fiction or fiction. But in Europe, it's like usual, like the mixing of both. So I was taking notes about her life. And then while I was opening the boxes of Rosika Schumer's archive, another boxes were opening in my mind. So I was remembering things about the women of my childhood. They were also feminist in the last part of the Franco's dictatorship in Spain and the beginning of the democracy. They were really liberal and feminist women. So I was a kind of child of those so progressive women. So reading about Rosika Schumer so was a kind of remembering myself, my childhood in the Basque Country in the 80s and 90s. So then there's the third plot line in the novel is our life here in New York. So the thing is that I was writing about Rosika Schumer, but then I was remembering things of my childhood and youthhood, and then I was writing a diary about our life, our new life, especially the life of my children here in New York. So it's a kind of a novel with three plot lines. But what I want to say is that it's impossible to tell everything. Yeah. It's yeah. So you have to forget things when you're writing a novel about a real character. You have to forget a lot of things, a lot of things. So this is really important because ellipses, silence, it's really, really important because the reader, if not, cannot go in the book. So those invisible threads, W.G. Siegel told about the invisible threads that are in the books. So those invisible threads are for the readers. So the readers need this silence, they need these ellipses to fill them, to fill with their imagination and with their, I don't know. So it's like, I don't like to tell everything about a real character. It's a kind of, you have to choose what to tell and what not to tell.
And how married did you feel to fact? Like, how important was it to accurately represent the details you did decide to share? And what were sort of bridges for your imagination?
Yeah, it's, you have to be really, really, like, close to, you have to be really honest, I mean, when you are telling the life of a real person, no? You have to be real honest, and you have to tell what happened, because one of the reasons is that you told about that, no? So tell stories that are silenced, that were silenced. So you have to be really honest with that person. But then fiction is necessary too. You need like salt or species are necessary in the food. You need a kind of fiction. So you have to imagine how those people lived. So everything is not told in the papers. You have to imagine. So that those parts of fiction are the I love them. So because you you feel free to imagine, to do fiction when you don't know things. So you have to construct or build scenes. You have to, it's a kind of, a license that you can do.
And then, Katerina, with the goddesses, you did a lot of research, you had said. You were taking oral histories, you went to the Carpathians. I'd be curious if you could enlighten us about that process of discovering their history.
Of course. So it was wonderful years when I made research about the goddesses. When I started to be interested in them, there was not much about them in literature, maybe in old literature from 19th century when the local priest informed about them, like about the women who upset them because they still follow some pagan rituals and pagan traditions, but some studies by contemporary ethnologists, but really not much. So I started with the journey to the region. I went to the White Carpathians, and 3 years, one after the other, I rent a cottage there, and I made the local research over the summers. I met the local people. I visited local archives, and I found really interesting things, like in archive, for example, which was near the village Žitková, where the story is set, was the old documents from the 20s it was Kurt archive. So at 20s was made a trial with the goddesses who conducted the black mass, and because the guy who was the subject of the black mass really died, they were believed to cause this death, and then were called to the court to describe what exactly they did. Finally, they were released because it wasn't proved that this kind of black mass was caused really the death of the man, if it was a coincidence or what. But in the records from this court was clear how such a black mass seemed, how it was conducted. And such a worthy document served me for creating a story. Another interesting type of documents was secret service files, which the secret police during the communist regime led for the goddesses, because they followed them. For the previous regime, they were a danger because a lot of people believed to their power, a lot of belief were loyal to the goddesses, so they were something like an ideological threat or ideological enemy for them. And the second thing was that they were paid by sometimes money, sometimes by some naturalities, natural things like was eggs or dove or something, by clients who goddesses helped too. So the previous regime, communist regime, see them as alternative medicine, alternative doctors who earned money, which was forbidden, of course, during the last regime by us, because it was uncontrolled money. And they followed them because of that to prove that they commit crimes, and the records of secret service agents was really wonderful. They, for example, was present to some rituals of picking the herbs in spring and summer, where goddesses make it naked, so they followed them to the woods and see naked women how they picking some herbs. And what was even more funny about this situation was how cold language they used to describe the situation, because of it was secret service agents who were employed from the they weren't educated. They were only loyal members of Communist Party, but their education was of elementary school. So their language was such primitive and cold that it was funny to read about such a situation. So it was great inspiration for my story. And what was even more inspiring was the meeting with the people from the local community in White Carpathians who remembered goddesses, and they remembered them really very with real emotion, with great emotion. Many of them loved them because they were really helpful for the community. But it was hard to find them. The White Carpathian is mountains, so cottages are in the wood. The village is not a village like you know, like the village with the church in the middle and the houses around the square. It's a kind of a village which consists from cottages or small houses. Does it work? The houses which are hidden. Thank you. So to find these people who can inform me about the fates and stories of goddesses, it was really hard to find them. But I was really lucky because one of the first people who I met there was a local teacher who was the old woman, and she was interested in my research, and I think that she adopted me somehow because I was a young student. She was teacher, so we made close relationships together. And thanks to her, I was able to visit the families because she took me to the cottages, into the woods, and she was present in my visit when I interviewed the people from these cottages. And because this region is known for its spirit, for the alcohol which is distilled there, it's a kind of strong alcohol, she was always offered usually offered some drinks. They offered it to me as well, and the situation went better and closer and more emotional, and people were talkative more and more. But it was really challenging, this kind of oral history research, because after two or three or four cottages we visited together, she was drunk, I was very tired, and we had really a lot of stories, but we were in the middle of the woods without signal. I had a mobile phone, but signal doesn't work there, and such a wonderful situation I lived through during the research. I missed them. So it was really, really interesting, challenging. And I collected really a lot of materials which I before even didn't hope in. It was really a lot what I collected. But then another part of the process started, that I had to find the thread, how to narrate the story. And from these mountains of material, documents, records, audio records, I had to narrate the story.
Oh, I'm so sorry to interrupt.
I'm sorry, I'm speaking long.
Oh no, unfortunately we're over time.
Really?
Yes, so sorry. We unfortunately have to wrap the panel so the breakout rooms can happen. But Laima, Anna, we'll hear from you and you can finish your discussions during the discussions in the breakout room. But I'd love it if everyone can give these great authors a round of applause.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Trafica Europe Radio. This was the second and last installment of European Literature Night 2023's replay. I'd like to take a moment to thank the Ukrainian Institute of America, the Czech Center in New York, UNIC New York, and PEN America for allowing Trafica Europe to be a part of this year's European Literature Night 2023. We look forward to seeing what the European Literature Night 2024 looks like and can't wait to be involved. In addition to this episode, another members-only audiobook excerpt has been released this week. If you're interested, please check out patreon.com/trafficaeurope to become an audiobook listener and get access to a wide variety of audio excerpts being released every week. Trafica Europe can only exist thanks to the donations of those who find what we do important. If you're financially able, any small donation can help us keep running to keep providing you with wonderful audio episodes and amazing literature published online for free. If you're not able to contribute financially, please consider commenting, liking, and sharing this podcast, as well as any other work that we do, as it helps us to reach a wider audience and keep creating a larger community of people around the world surrounding the topic of European literature and culture. Thank you so much for listening, and tune in next week for an episode with Mish Beyer, who will be talking about her writing in Breton.